It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. A new report shows Wisconsin is on pace to have more deaths than births in the not-too-distant future. That may not sound like a good trend, but our guest says there are some silver linings worth mentioning. We'll look at that data coming up. First, this week marks the one-year anniversary of the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The mass shooting is one of the deadliest hate crimes in American history. If you've been watching the news over the last few years, it may feel like we're seeing a lot of violence and hate in our communities, like the incident in Pittsburgh or the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin shooting in Oak Creek 7 years ago. One Wisconsin group likens these violent incidents and the hate that goes along with them to a national addiction. That group has unveiled a new 12-step program that they say will help combat violence and hate-related incidents. Masood Akhtar is the founder of We Are Many, United Against Hate. Masood, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
And Mike McCabe is executive director of that group. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, Masood, why did you and your group want to tackle this issue with this 12-step program you're calling it?
I think it's critical because initially in the last couple of years, we have been heavily focusing on educational programs, going to colleges and high schools and other places, and that has some significant impact on this youth to deal with this kind of problem. And now we are taking it to the next step in terms of what really needs to be done, what are the root causes of this, taking a much broader look at that and see how we can provide the resources that are needed.
And that's in what you have on your website about this, Mike. That's the core idea here, instead of trying to tackle symptoms, looking for root causes.
Yeah, nobody is born hating. Nobody is born being violent. These are behaviors that are learned, and they don't just happen. They are caused. There are underlying causes to what ends up manifesting itself as anger and hate and violence. And so, you know, we're trying to at least stimulate a discussion about what some of those causes are and how we would get at uprooting them.
Before we get to the 12 steps, Masood, I mentioned just two incidents out of many. Can you talk about what you see out there when it comes to hate in the United States, whether it ends up resulting in violence or not?
Yeah, I think the hate crimes have increased substantially in the last few years. The other trend that we are noticing is that the rise in hate is because of this white supremacist group. And not only public in general is concerned about it, but also law enforcement officers like FBI is very concerned about what they are seeing. And they started looking at it as more like a domestic terrorism. That's the word that wasn't there before. The terrorism word was always associated with international people doing that. These people also have the same ideology as ISIS and others. So because of that, there are a lot of activities that are going on. And FBI is very concerned about it and talking to U.S. House of Representatives to deal with it.
Mike, let's get into some of the items on your 12-step list here. The first one on the list is relieve economic stress. That might people might say, wait, what does that have to do with hate and bigotry? What does it have to do
with? It has everything to do with it. You know, we've got a member of our advisory board, Arno Michaelis, who's a former white supremacist. And if you ask Arno how he went out and recruited people, and he started one of the world's largest racist skinhead organizations, and a member of that organization was the shooter in that Oak Creek Temple slaughter that you mentioned in 2012. And what he said is that violent extremist ideologies prey on economic stresses like joblessness, economic insecurity, inequality. And that's how they recruit. They go and look for people who are really struggling economically, and then they offer up a scapegoat. They say, "This is why you're not getting your fair shake in society."
It's one thing to identify that as a problem. Of what prescriptions do you offer? This is something people have been trying to tackle for centuries. Right?
Yeah. Well, think about the economic stresses that people feel. A lot of times, people are trapped in jobs that they can't stand, and they stay there because otherwise they don't have any ability to get health care. And so detaching employment from health care and creating a system in this country where people have access to health care regardless of their employment status, that would be something that would be a huge benefit to people, that would relieve some of the economic stresses that end up boiling over in too many cases.
Masood, another item on the list is destigmatize and decriminalize mental health. Why do you see that as an important part of the picture?
Well, it's important in the sense that sometimes it is used as a reason to justify why these people are doing these kind of activities, and it becomes a political issue. So it's important that, yes, we have to pay attention to these mental health issues and then try to figure this out. The thing that causes problem for the Muslim community in this particular case is that when a Muslim is a shooter, you don't talk about this situation. You only talk about mental health issues if the shooter is not a Muslim. So we are bringing this issue to attention that, you know, that's, this is an important issue we need to deal with.
We're talking about a 12-step program against hate and violent extremism. Our guests are with the group We Are Many, United Against Hate, Masood Akhtar and Mike McCabe. They have 12 steps that they say will at least start to deal with problems of hate and violence in the United States. Mike, here's an interesting one that people maybe don't think about much of this. Reconnect with nature. What's that? Why is that on this list?
In our society, we, so many of us do so much medicating to deal with chronic pain and the overwhelming stresses that people are under, and in the medical community, you're increasingly hearing physicians say we got to prescribe less medication and we've got to get people to reconnect with the outdoors, because being in nature is known to reduce stress, to reduce blood pressure, to reduce heart rate, to get at so many of the underlying causes that end up producing the sort of anxiety that ends up morphing in some cases to violence, either domestic violence or these outbursts of violence in the community.
Masood, this is quite a mixed bag. I'll stop at those three for now. Who is this message going out to? Who are you hoping looks at this list and says, yeah, we need to take action on some or all of these items?
I think two areas that we are focusing on, two audience. One is public, that we would like them to play a major role into these kinds of debates and start talking about it, start aiming, particularly those that are located in rural communities. And I think it's very important to do that. The other one is, obviously, our group is nonpartisan, so this is one of those areas we want have these, our elected officials of both parties, to look into it a little bit deeper of why this hate is happening, what is the root cause of this. And, you know, the surprising part of that is that there are 15 hate groups right here in Wisconsin. So we have to deal with this seriously.
And, Mike, where do you see, say, those government officials and the political parties missing the boat when it comes to confronting hate?
Well, as Masood said, there's been a 20% increase in the number of hate groups across the country, and there's 15 operating right here in Wisconsin. And you know, we've seen one mass shooting after another, and after every one of those mass shootings, after every eruption of hate and violence, there's this debate that goes nowhere in the halls of Congress and in state legislatures. Some people say you've got to do something about guns, and then somebody says, no, we got to do something about video games, and it ends up being a circular discussion that ends up going nowhere. But they're all dealing with symptoms, and they're not dealing with underlying causes of these problems. So what we're trying to do is stimulate a discussion that hate is not just the symptoms that appear on the surface. There are root causes to this. It's not unlike alcoholism. There are reasons why people succumb to that disease, and then some people find the strength to overcome that disease with a 12-step program. What we're suggesting is maybe we should think about a 12-step program that gets to the bottom of America's addiction with hate and violence. And that's not happening in the state capitol. It's not happening on Capitol Hill out in Washington, D.C. So we're trying to stimulate a conversation to get the public engaged and saying, let's look at where this actually comes from and try to address those root causes.
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. This topic is essential. I want to applaud you for having this discussion. I think that we have to just focus on the real causes of hate, and that's whiteness in all its forms and any political dissension, like people who are pro-life, people who are religious. That's where all hate comes from, because they are bad whites, and they don't understand. You just have to, you know, just don't be white, and don't be
Dave, I'm going to jump in. That's not what you said you were going to call in about. I'm not sure where you're going with that, but Masood, any thoughts on what Dave had to say?
Yeah, I didn't get that somehow.
I guess the only thing I would say, Rob, is that we have to be careful about saying that it's somebody else's problem and that the problem is simply coming from some other and they've got to deal with their problems and then the problem will go away. It's more deep-seated than that. And it's something that we all have to wrestle with. And this requires soul-searching for all of us. And if we don't address fundamental problems with the way our society's operating today, and that's all of our responsibility, we're not going to get a handle on this problem.
I think where Dave was going, I think he was kind of parodying something that talking about race means you're blaming white people inherently for the problems, and that the idea of talking about race is inherently divisive. Do we need to talk more about race?
I think we should. This country is built on some of these things, pretty, pretty unique, and that does not exist in other countries. And I think I would like to see white people speaking more about this as a part of this, that, hey, we will not even tolerate these kinds of things. We need to recognize that the problem exists. And I think everybody, regardless of their color, religion, or ethnicity, or political affiliation, should come forward and work together, because there is a lot of division going on right now. And we just want to make sure that the beauty of this country is something is very new. This is something very important. We want to make sure this country remains united and not divided.
We're talking to Masood Akhtar and Mike McCabe of the group We Are Many, United Against Hate. They're with us to talk about the group's new 12-step style program that aims to combat what it calls a national addiction to hate and violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about some of the ideas you've heard so far? Do you agree that our country seems to have an addiction, or at least is feeding on violence and hate? What do you think needs to change to bring people together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Masood Akhtar and Mike McCabe of the group We Are Many, United Against Hate. They recently released a 12-step style program aimed at turning the tide on hate and violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see racially motivated hate in your community? What do you think drives this? What steps do you think should be taken to alleviate hate and violence in your community? Do you have a question for our guests about their ideas? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on another caller now. Sarah is with us in Lodi. Sarah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Sarah?
Well, I was thinking about this at the time, you know, when we started talking really about bullying, and we were telling kids to stand up against bullies, stand their ground against bullies. And then all of a sudden we have this huge influx of guns in our country. And then you have states like Florida who create a law that says, stand your ground, and if you feel threatened by someone, it's okay to shoot them. And sometimes I think we just, as adults or as people working on these problems or discussing this, we don't really look at how we name things, how we talk about things. And it's very disturbing to me.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Masood, the way we talk, the language we use, Sarah's worried about.
Yeah, I think it's important that these issues should be discussed at different level and brought to everybody's attention. You know, we have been to so many schools now, and we hear this all the time. And as you might have heard, N-word is getting out, and everybody's talking about it. Talking about is a good starting point. And I think that's where Mike and I are coming from, is let's just start some dialogues, but at the same time, dig deep into it. What is causing this, and what really needs to be done to solve it? So I think that Sarah's question is very important for this kind of conversation.
Thanks for that call, Sarah. I want to get into some other items on your 12-step program here. Mike, one of them is incarcerate less, educate more. How does that fit in?
Well, that even relates to one of them that you brought up earlier about destigmatizing and decriminalizing mental health. the way our society is currently dealing with mental health challenges more than anything, any other approach is through imprisonment. That's the biggest response of our society to mental health challenges is to lock people away. And of course that leads nowhere good. And so we've got to take mental health seriously and, you know, we've got to get away from this approach of locking people up and throwing away the key and thinking that will do away with the problems of violence. Truth is, you look at right across the border to Minnesota, there's a state with half the prison population Wisconsin has, and yet Wisconsin and Minnesota have virtually identical crime rates. So there's something that Minnesota has discovered that Wisconsin so far hasn't discovered, that simply locking people away is not an effective remedy for crime. And so, you know, we've got to get to the root causes of misbehavior and criminal behavior if we're really going to get a handle on these problems. So, you know, that this step really relates to that earlier step that you brought up as well about destigmatizing mental health challenges.
And Masood, another item on the list, dedicates ourselves to inclusive communities. That sounds like one of those things that's easy to say and harder to put into practice. What are you looking for?
It is, but I think somebody has to start it, right? I mean, the diversity is there, and we need to do some little bit educational part of it that, hey, America promotes unity, not uniformity, and that's the beauty of this country, that everybody's opinion is respected, and we need to take that into consideration.
We are talking to Mike McCabe and Masood Akhtar from We Are Many, United Against Hate, looking at what they're calling a 12-step program aimed at dealing with hate and hopefully preventing hate-based violence. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Chris with us in Stevens Point. Chris, hi.
Hello. Basically what I wanted to kind of add to the conversation is a lot of what you guys have been saying is great, and I really feel that people on both sides, I think things would be less polarized if we all took time to really use effective listening techniques and listen to one another to really get to those root causes. I think too many times, I mean, even if you have a legitimate question on something that is related to any of these hate type of things, that if you're on maybe the side that's viewed as hateful, you know, you try to speak up and you really get shut down and we wave fingers too many times rather than try to figure out why do they feel that way? How can we change their minds? Because it doesn't seem that just taking the moral stance is very effective. We have to set aside our own attitudes and really listen to these people and figure out what are the root causes to this hate.
Chris, thanks for the call. Mike, what do you think? Listening.
Amen. You know, and one of the things that's been delightful ever since we put this out is, you know, we put forward 12 steps. But then other people have said this should be the 13th step or this should be the 14th step. But that's exactly what we're looking for, is to start a conversation, not to end one. We're not saying that we've got all the answers. We're saying, think about this. Think about how any of these things are underneath the hate and the violence that are so pervasive in our society. Now, how do we get at that? And then what that does is it stimulates people to think, and we need to listen to that. If we can just start a good conversation here, then this is all worth it, and it's a step forward.
Now, some people might hear that, Masood, and think, well, wait a minute. What if I'm part of whatever group, and this person over here, literally part of the ideology they're propounding is that I should be dead or exiled from this country? Do we need to listen even then?
I think this is very important that you have to reach out to those who really don't like what we're talking about. This is the only way you can make a change. You know, we typically talk to a preaching the choir kind of situation. We have to do really extra effort to reach out to those who are not coming out and speaking about this and don't want to be engaged, but that's critical. I think that's one of the purpose we came on this show, is to reach out to those people, particularly those in rural communities where we have very little discussion on this particular topic. I want them to actually reach out to us and arrange some kind of this conversation so we can actively participate and engage those people as well. That's the only way we're going to make a change.
That reminds me, you mentioned Arno Michaelis, who's on your board. You said he was on the show a few weeks back, and I remember him talking about the people who changed him from being a white supremacist leader were coworkers, colleagues who were people of color who literally he was organizing violence against.
Mm-hmm. He was. His goal was to kill them or drive them out of this country. And yet acts of common decency by those people, acts of humanity by those people is what ended up stopping his hate dead in its tracks and starting him down a different path. And we recently ran into another man in Fort Atkinson who has been a white nationalist and is devoted to this being an all-white country and wants everybody who's not white to either leave the country or be dead. But what turned him around, he was in the military and his unit was ambushed and the man who saved his life was an African-American soldier. That started to get him thinking about this ideology he had, and it started him down a different path. And so when you think about what really stops hate dead in its tracks, it's not a violent response. It's not dealing with some of the symptoms and you know, throwing around platitudes about those symptoms. It really is about digging down to what's at the root of it. And so often, as with Arno, it was an act of humanity by somebody of a different race that started him thinking, maybe I've got it all wrong here.
Masood, in our last few moments, that puts a lot of weight on people of color. It sounds like they have to do a lot of the work here. How can everybody help to bring that humanity on board? So it isn't just on the victims of hate to be responsible to change things.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you sit down or engage, I think that's the critical part of it. There's a lot of hate and a lot of confusion out there and a lot of misunderstanding about each other. Somebody has not seen somebody in that community. So dialogue has to start, and I think it would be good if people in different communities can take the responsibility and start bringing this. That's one of the things we are doing when we go to schools. Now there is these kids from different diverse background coming and say, hey, can we start the chapter of We Are Many United Against Hate? That's how you build the communities.
Masood, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting us.
And Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Rob.
Been talking to Masood Akhtar, entrepreneur and founder of We Are Many United Against Hate, and Mike McCabe, executive director of that group. They join us today to talk about the organization's 12-step program to tackle what it calls an addiction to hate and violence in our country. Coming up after the news, we'll look at a new report that says the next few years, Wisconsin could be headed toward a natural decrease in population. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has identified 120 more impaired waterways in the state. We'll talk to the DNR's freshwater expert about the damage they're seeing and what can be done to rehabilitate those waterways. First, a new report shows Wisconsin's population may start trending downward before too long. According to Forward Analytics, the number of births in the state dropped 12% from 2007 to 2018. It's at the lowest point in 46 years. At this pace, the group says there would be more deaths than births in the next 5 to 6 years. Other states are also experiencing declines in births, which our guest says may present some big economic problems down the road, but there are also some silver linings in the new report. Dale Knapp is director of research at Forward Analytics, a division of the Wisconsin Counties Association. The report, which came out today, is called The Birth Dearth, Falling Fertility Rates, Fewer Babies. Dale, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here this afternoon, Rob.
Well, spell it out for us a little more. What's happening when it comes to birth rates here in Wisconsin?
Well, as you mentioned, the 2018, the number of births here, just over 64,000, was the lowest since 1973. And birth and birth rates have been on the decline since 2007. And the recent decline was really unexpected because rates were expected to turn up once the economy turned around after 2012. Births tend to fall in recessions and turn back up when the economy gets strong. And that hasn't happened. And so that's what's most alarming is that the rates continue to fall with very few data points, you know, pointing that they're going to turn, you know, in the near future here, which is really troubling.
What are some of the stories behind that number? What are the demographics showing us that, these birth numbers are going down? Who is not having kids?
Sure. Well, we tend to blame millennials for this, that you know, we talk about millennials and they're not marrying as early and they're not having kids. And that there's some truth to that. The median age of women having their first child has gone from about 24 to 26 since 2007. So women are having their first child later, and so that has helped bring the number of births down. But the biggest factor, the factor that's had the most influence on this decline, is actually good news in that the birth rate, the teen birth rate, has dropped precipitously since 2007. So 2007, women 15 to young girls, actually women 15 to 19, had about 32 babies per 1,000 women. That's down to under 14. So that, which is good news, because we know children born to teen mothers face a lot of disadvantages and tend to struggle, in many ways academically. They tend to be more likely in poverty. So the fact that teen birth rates are really at historic lows is good news for us.
Another part of the story, people talk about Wisconsin's aging population. We'll be talking about an aging workforce tomorrow on the show. Are we seeing people in their prime childbearing years staying here in Wisconsin?
Well, that's one of the challenges that we face is, and we documented some of this, not with women, but with the overall population, is that Wisconsin has not done very well over the past 7 or 8 years in terms of retaining and attracting millennials. And so if you look at the female population that was 15 to 19 in 2000, as they've now aged, they're in their early 30s where birth rates are the highest. We lost about 8% of that population over those 15 years. And the millennials that are right behind them that were 15 to 19 in 2005, the losses have been even greater. And so we need to do that. That's another factor that's driving this decline. And we need to do a better job of not just attracting the young women that age, but really attracting both males and females of the millennials and then the Generation Z that's following them.
Talking to Dale Knapp from Forward Analytics, a division of the Wisconsin Counties Association, looking at their new report on birth rates and death rates here in Wisconsin. We are knocking on the door of a situation where deaths are exceeding births. This doesn't come up very much. Dale, what are the economic consequences of this? What has you worried here?
Well, this is going on nationally as well. And so, you know, one of the first things that we think about is the solvency of Social Security and of Medicare. The solvency of those programs are based on the number of recipients, you know, at the older end, and then the number of workers paying into that. If the workforce is shrinking, which it's looking to in Wisconsin, possibly over the next several years, that solvency issue becomes the issue, basically moves up in time. In Wisconsin, what it means is a somewhat permanent workforce shortage. We're looking at the possibility that firms that are trying to grow aren't going to be able to find the workers, and possibly moving to other states where the workforce is growing. So there's really some long-term consequences for the state in terms of the economy. And if there's fewer workers working, if businesses are moving away, that impacts tax revenue to the state, to counties, to municipalities, et cetera. And so there's fewer dollars to do the things that we need government to do.
Does this look different depending on where you are in the state, north, south, urban, rural, you name it?
It does. One of the things that when you dig into the numbers a little bit, surprisingly, birth rates in northern Wisconsin actually have been going up some. Their challenge is, while the birth rates are going up, the number of young women of prime birthing age has been declining significantly. So that's really a challenge there. And you see the declines in birth rates are a little bit higher in urban areas than they are in the rural areas in general.
Is there anything you're hoping to see from a policy perspective here?
Well, this is where it's challenging. There's a lot of people throw out various policies, and there's been a lot of policies that have been tried, in other countries. And the effectiveness of these policies are fairly mixed, and sometimes they're very costly. One of the policies that people propose is making sure that childcare is more affordable, we know it's very expensive. And what people miss is there's sort of two impacts of those kinds of policies. One, what we generally think of it by making childcare more affordable, it's easier to have that extra child to some degree. It's not quite as costly. So in that sense, it tends to be pronatal. On the other hand, there's another impact that's less discussed, in that when childcare becomes less expensive, there's a slightly greater attachment to the workforce for women, which actually has an antenatal impact to it. So there's effects on both sides that we have to think about. It's not clear that you get a big boost, in fertility from that kind of a policy. Now, that kind of a policy might have other positive effects that you might want to pursue it. So there's been a lot of things tried. The challenge is nothing has proven definitively effective at turning birth rates around.
Ben in La Crosse left us a message. He says encouraging immigration into the state rather than more births is the best route. He's worried about overpopulation globally. So what about the immigration side of things?
Well, both nationally and in Wisconsin, when you look at the demographics, immigration has to be part of the solution. In particular in Wisconsin, where it looks increasingly like our workforce is actually going to shrink over the next 10 or 15 years. So that has to be part of the answer. And depending on where those immigrants come from, some of them come from parts of the world that actually birth rates are higher than they are here. Some of them would be coming from Europe, where you get that population here, but birth rates are as low as they are, or sometimes lower than they are in the U.S. So it's got to be part of the solution. But we know right now that's a real hot topic in Washington and a very divisive topic.
Dale, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
That's Dale Knapp, Director of Research at Forward Analytics, a division of the Wisconsin Counties Association. We talked to him about Forward's new report that shows that the state could have more deaths than it does births in the next 5 to 6 years. Coming up, the state DNR has found more than 120 new polluted or impaired waterways in Wisconsin. We'll find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump dropped his plan to host the G7 summit at his Doral Resort following backlash from both sides of the political aisle. His original plan to host the international event also courted allegations that he was violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. We'll break down the latest argument coming up. First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has identified 120 new impaired waterways around the state. As part of the Clean Water Act, Wisconsin officials assess bodies of water across the state every 2 years. As part of the latest survey, the state is recommending adding 106 waterways to its impaired list and 14 more under new water restoration guidelines in 2020. Our next guest joins us to talk about some of the dangers these impaired waterways are facing and steps the state could take to repair the damage. Ashley Baranek is the Water Quality Evaluation Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. Ashley, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what goes into deciding whether or not a waterway gets listed as being impaired?
So an impairment determination is based on water quality data and our regional biologists. We take a look at the data, we compare it against the thresholds that we've determined would mean that there's too much of that pollutant. And then I send out a draft list to all of our regional DNR folks. They take a look at it, and then we put out this list for public comment.
We've got a lot of water here in Wisconsin.
We
lakes,
do.
Rivers, ponds, streams, you name it. Can you really keep up with all of it, or do you have to kind of pick and choose where you're surveying?
So we try to do as much as we can. We have 30% of our waters assessed, but like you said, we have a lot of water. We have over 1,000 acres of lake, and we have over 80,000 stream miles. So what we do is we focus on different areas of the state. Right now, one of the areas we're focusing on are the counties along the northeast lakeshore of Lake Michigan, because we are working on a new TMDL, which is a restoration plan in that area. So a lot of our phosphorus listings from this cycle, say, are from a lot of monitoring we've done in that area.
You just mentioned phosphorus, and you're looking at different pollutants here, but looking at the charts, this is the biggest part of the story, the phosphorus.
Yeah.
Talk about where that's coming from and why we worry about it.
So phosphorus comes from multiple sources. It can come from municipal waste, it can come from industries, and it can come from agriculture. We work on all of those sources where we know that there's phosphorus going into the water, and then areas where it's running off of the land into the water. So we're worried about phosphorus because it can contribute to algal blooms, which can be an issue in, say, if you want to go swimming in a lake and it's pretty green, you may not want to jump in there. And it could cause things like toxic algal blooms. So decreasing algae is one of our goals, and to do that, we decrease phosphorus. It's also a big picture thing because the phosphorus that runs into the Mississippi River runs all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. So what we do here in Wisconsin will help the nation.
When we say a waterway is impaired by this standard, that doesn't mean we're not already working on it, right? Some of the
Correct.
Places, maybe even the ones just added to this list, there's already a plan in the works for it?
Yeah, you're right. So we have the restoration waters list now, and that specifically shows all the waters where we have a restoration plan. So a bunch of the phosphorus listings that we had this time went right on the restoration waters list because we already have a TMDL in place, and they're, for example, the Wisconsin River TMDL. That's a large portion of the middle of the state, and I had some new listings in that area, but they're already covered by that TMDL.
If we're talking about phosphorus, say, in a river, what does our plan look like? How do we start restoring? I understand it's hard to take phosphorus out.
Right. But one of the things we do is we reduce the amount of phosphorus going in. And some landscape restoration, like, say, a stream that has a degraded shoreline, if we can restore that shoreline, that'll decrease the amount of sediment flowing into the water, and then that'll decrease the amount of phosphorus going in as well.
We're talking to Ashley Baranek from the state DNR, looking at new listings of impaired waterways around the state and how the DNR is tackling the different kinds of pollutants that go into them. So phosphorus, the big story here, not the only story, though. What are some of the other pollutants that show up on a list like this?
So one of the other major pollutants that's been showing up is chloride, and that comes from our use of road salt and water softeners. So that one around larger cities is starting to show up. And we've listed this cycle a few more waters in the Milwaukee city area.
What do you do with a plan on that? Because people like their water softeners and
they
worry about ice on the roads.
So we still want to maintain public safety. That's our major goal right there. But there are ways to reduce the amount of salt, road salt that we use. We can alternate some sands in. We can use some things like brine from manufacturing or producing pickles or cheeses. Even.
I've heard the cheese brine alternative.
Yeah. So those are some of the options that we can use. And it can help if people reduce the amount they put on their sidewalks. So if you look at the DNR website or even your local county website, they may have ways to reduce your amount of road salt and sidewalk salt.
I know a big pollutant that people used to talk about a lot and be worried about, especially if they went fishing, was mercury in our waterways.
Yeah.
What do we see in the mercury landscape these days?
So we have a statewide fish consumption advisory for mercury that covers all of our waters. So if you're looking at our mercury listings this cycle, you'll notice that we recommended a lot for delisting. So this was more of a clerical cleanup. So there, in 2001, we got that really great coverage for the entire state. And then we had a few waters, about 90, that were still on the impaired waters list, even though they didn't have specific fish consumption advisories for mercury. So that was a little bit of something we needed to clean up. So this cycle, we removed, I think, about 90 waters for mercury. And the reason we did this is that it was confusing folks. It's like, why is my water on the impaired waters list when there's no issue that I can see?
Okay, so they might have had mercury in the past, or they were just still covered under the old statewide advisory and they hadn't been taken off the list.
That was it. Yeah, gotcha. They're covered under that statewide. They're lower than the statewide consumption advisory.
Are there, you mentioned northeastern Wisconsin, are there other parts of the state where we have particular concentrated concerns with the waters in that area?
So it really is regional. There are areas where there's higher phosphorus. There's in northern counties, we do have some more issues with mercury in lakes. So it does depend on where you are in the state. We've got some great cleanup plans all across the state. So like we had the Wisconsin River TMDL. We had an upper Fox Wolf River TMDL. These are a lot of ones that were phosphorus specific, looking at those.
Do we have a lot of long-term data on the same waterway where we declared it impaired in year whatever, and we're tracking progress over time and seeing how our efforts are paying off, if they're paying off?
Yeah, so we have long-term trend sites on a lot of rivers in the state, and some of those are impaired, and we're able to check trends of pollutants across time. So one really good message from our long-term trend monitoring is that phosphorus concentrations are decreasing over time. So hopefully, as we continue doing cleanup, we'll see that trend continue.
Is there a place where people can go and say, okay, hey, what about this lake in my town or the river in my backyard or whatever? Is there a place they can go and see if there are concerns about that waterway?
Yeah. So if you go onto the DNR's webpage and you search for impaired waters, that'll bring you to our webpage. And you should be able to find a way to search for specific water bodies. And on those pages, you can see, is your water impaired, or potentially, is my water healthy? Because that's another thing we've been highlighting this time around.
And you mentioned guidelines on use of salt. Are there other kind of tips for maybe consumers or business owners or farmers, you name it, where they can see if their practices could help things out?
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff on our website about best management practices on farms. And if you're curious about different pollutants, you can look at those as well. Like we have ways that you could reduce phosphorus use in your own home, like making sure that you don't use a ton of compost on your lawn or different types of fertilizer and pesticides. So there's just some ways that we can each individually reduce the amount of phosphorus we're putting into the water.
And these reports come out every 2 years. I assume you don't stop and start. Somebody's probably out in the field or on the shores, I guess, taking samples maybe right now.
Yeah, we are constantly monitoring. We have folks out there every year, and we have volunteers around the state that help us as well. So we're getting quite a bit of information coming in. And yeah, I'm on a continuous cycle. As soon as this one's done, I'm starting on the next one.
And then once we have this report out, what are you hoping people take away from it, whether the public at large or decision makers in our last few moments?
Yeah, I'd like to highlight that 82% of our waters are in good condition and that the Clean Water Act really requires us to have public input on this process. So I'm really looking forward to hearing from folks on our update to the lists.
Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today
Thank you. Thank you.
That's Ashley Baranek. She's Water Quality Evaluation Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She joined us to talk about impaired waterways the DNR has added to the list, also ones that have been taken off, and some good news about waterways that have never made it onto that list, plus what steps can be taken to rehabilitate these areas. Again, as she mentioned, you can check out the DNR's website to find out ways that homeowners, business owners, farmers, and others can help make a difference when it comes to phosphorus and other pollutants. You've heard of people sending a message in a bottle. Well, it turns out Wisconsin accidentally sent our neighbors in Michigan a message in a barrel. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, an orange and white traffic barrel, you know, like the ones you see in road construction, washed up on the shores of Muskegon, Michigan. That's the town on the other side of the Lake Michigan Ferry. Stenciled on that barrel were the letters MILWDPW, as in Milwaukee Department of Public Works. That barrel washed up about 2 weeks ago in a park on the shores of Michigan. And the city of Muskegon has had some fun with it since then. On their social media accounts, they've named it Daryl the Barrel. It's a good rhyme. I would have gone with Daryl. What is next for Daryl? Well, they've posted pictures of Daryl at scenic Muskegon parks and landmarks and even gotten public input. What restaurants or other prominent places should Daryl show up at? And according to the Muskegon City Clerk, Daryl is pretty free-spirited, so we don't know what he has planned. Maybe someone from the city of Milwaukee will call us and we can discuss it. This is a pretty ambitious barrel because that's about, if my internet sources are right, just over 80 miles as the barrel floats from Milwaukee to Muskegon, more than I'd want to swim by, well, many factors. So send a message to Daryl. Check out the city of Muskegon's social media accounts while you're there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.